720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth and James Van Osdell. We're in for Bill and Wendy today. We're going to let this song play a little bit. It's a good one. And we're going to wish safe passage to Lemmy. To Lemmy of Motorhead. It's good stuff. We're feeling it.
All right.
We felt our Motorhead. There. It's good.
Later on, we'll play We Are the Road Crew.
We're just going to play all Motorhead today. Uh-huh.
You know, it's interesting. And you are a journalist. And I was presented with a journalistic dilemma yesterday. I knew about Lemmy's passing about an hour and a half before it was announced.
All right.
It wasn't really a dilemma. To me, it's like, okay, I knew about it through people who knew him. Mm-hmm. I didn't share it with anybody. That wasn't my business to share that information.
Sure.
I figured at some point it would come out. I was told it would come out.
Let's back up a little and say, you know, this was kind of a shocking thing because Lemmy of Motorhead was diagnosed with cancer just like the day after Christmas.
Yeah.
Like on December 26th.
Well, we knew something was wrong with him. I mean,
sure.
Here's a guy who had to cancel concerts. That's not something that Lemmy does. He, you know, cut his set short. We knew something was up. He went to the doctor, found out he had a horrible cancer, and then, you know, two days
later.
Apparently
a very aggressive, you know, variety.
But I found out about it, and I thought, okay, well, this news will come out through proper channels, through family or the band or whatever. Eddie Trunk, the guy who does the metal show on VH1,
sure.
Broke the
he
news
was all
on
over
Twitter.
Well, someone's got to break the news.
But
are you saying that it should have been like a family member?
Or the band, yeah.
Okay.
I felt like he probably found out the same way I found out, through a friend of a friend. Mm-hmm. I felt like, journalism aside, it wasn't my business to share that information with the public.
That's fair.
It wasn't my story to share. Someone died, a legend, an icon. Eddie Trunk, he's a metal guy. He's in with all those people. He broke it on Twitter. Maybe he was given the green light. I just thought it was bad form to put it out there before the band got to put it out there.
That's fair. But you know what? I think there's a kind of, not new way of thinking, but I think we think about breaking news in such a different way now because of Twitter. I think there's such a rush to be first.
Yeah, for sure there is.
Which is what makes mistakes happen, you mm-hmm. know, because sometimes people are in such a rush to be first, they, you know, accuracy can go out the window.
Yeah, there's
a little
no fact-checking.
Yeah, and that can be a problem. I mean, we've seen that from even major news outlets. I mean, one that comes to mind almost immediately was right after the Boston Marathon bombing, there was maybe a day or two after, during the lockdown of Boston mm-hmm. and kind of the manhunt and all that, there was a day that CNN started reporting something captured. No, wait, no one's captured. We're good. Nope, just kidding.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and kind of had to backtrack a little, but it quickly started to trend on social media because you can't unring a bell. So, I mean, I think sometimes people, and I think there's a sense of empowerment of having the first, you know, being the first to tell a story that sometimes people rushed and kind of, you know, jumped the gun on that or don't think, okay, well, this is a human being that has just jumped off the mortal coil.
Yeah.
Maybe I should let the spouse or band or whatever tell that story.
Just seems like the right thing to do. And Lemmy, I mean, that aside, Lemmy was an icon.
Sure.
I was talking about this with my friend Chris earlier today. It is difficult to think of anyone else of that class or chemical makeup. There's no other rock star who lived it and talked it and walked it. Really, Keith Richards is it. After Keith goes, there's no one else of that hard living that life. I can't think of another rock star of that.
I know, I'm sitting here trying to think of who that would be.
You can maybe say Angus Young from AC/DC,
yeah,
but I think he's cleaned up a little bit.
Right, he's cleaned up his act.
Maybe Halford from Judas Priest, but I mean, Lemmy was pure rock and roll. He didn't care what people thought. He had nothing left to give. He just said what was on his mind. He was a hard-drinking, hard-partying rock and roll animal.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is a different generation. Like, I think even Slash has cleaned up a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I bet he has a minivan now.
Exactly.
He's clean living and eating kale salad.
Yeah. So, I mean, Lemmy was the last of those hard-living, true embodiments of rock and roll. And I will say Motorhead was probably the loudest band I've ever seen in concert.
Mm-hmm.
Motorhead was one of the few bands where I made a point of taking earplugs to the show. Because have you ever been to one of those concerts where you can feel the sound coming off the amplifier?
You can just feel it in the ground
it
and
just
in the
like
walls.
It pushes at you. That was Motorhead live. And they were awesome.
What show did you see? Where were they playing?
House of Blues a few years back. Yeah, I mean, small venue, louder than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Motorhead was pure rock and roll. And, I mean, this effectively ends the band, obviously. And the band, or the remaining member of Motorhead has said as much. But Lemmy was cool. He was totally
and only
cool.
70.
Yeah.
I mean,
although he did
in rock and roll years, 70 is
he lived several 100. Lifetimes in that 70
right,
years.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so it's a bummer. I guess no one was surprised. I mean, the cancer came really quick, but
I mean, that just sounds so horrifying to me. I was thinking of that. Imagine being diagnosed the 26th.
Yeah.
Days.
But again, I think, I mean, there were signs.
Things.
Yeah, something was something
right.
was
It wasn't
on.
Like he was running a marathon on the 25th and then 26th this diagnosis right. happened. Like something propelled him to
like a lot of us were attention. Wondering if the band would play Riot Fest.
Yeah.
Because he had canceled and because there were some health concerns raised. And a lot of people saw Motorhead at Riot Fest, as morbid as the sounds, thinking, well, this may be the last chance to see Motorhead. Because
yeah.
Lemmy's health was in question
sure.
before then.
Sure.
And they were amazing. So, R.I.P. Lemmy.
Pour some out for Lemmy.
Pour some out. you've got to think, wherever that memorial service is held, wherever that private ceremony is held.
Oh, man.
That's going to be like an A-list of hard rock and metal getting together and throwing down hard.
Yeah. I can hope. I would hope it would not be the Wind Beneath My Wings sort of funeral.
No,
I hope it would be like a hell yeah, rock and roll kind of funeral.
That will not be a somber gathering. That'll be loud. It'll be boozy.
Yeah.
It'll be a bacchanal. It'll be amazing.
I mean, that's what most of us can only hope for, right?
You know, when I go, that's what I want.
Oh, yeah.
I want people to have a good time.
Sure.
Say, oh, yeah, he was cool. Let's...
This is what Guth would have wanted.
Exactly.
That's what I want them to say. That's what I want them to say.
So we have stuff going on.
We've got lots of stuff today. Lots of stuff. Well, you picked up the paper like you were going to say what that stuff was. I was going to let you at it.
It's my prop. Rex Hupke from the Tribune will be joining us at 1:30.
We love the guy. He, on the show I do here in the evenings, I call him the official, unofficial political correspondent of the Amy Guth Show.
He's great.
He's great.
Super talented writer. Then at 2 o'clock, Jesse Valenciano, the founder of the Meat Social Club ManBQ, will be talking New Year's Eve stuff. Drinks you should be considering for your New Year's Eve celebration. Foods you should consider making,
all of
cooking,
those things.
Serving.
Because you know what? New Year's Eve doesn't necessarily have to be a big throwdown. It doesn't necessarily have to be going out, spending lots of money. Sometimes it can be just a cool, chill gathering.
And sometimes those are the best New Year's Eves ever.
Indeed.
So that's coming up at 2. Lots going on here at WGN. James Van Ostel and Amy Guth.
WGN, Amy Guth and James Van Ostel here in for Bill and Wendy today. All of the lights just went out in the studio. What just happened?
It's because Steve Krasanich just walked in. He likes to set a mood.
What are you doing?
The second he enters a room.
Suddenly my eyesight got very poor.
Hi, Steve Krasanich.
Hello.
Miss you. Love you.
They're having a little bromance over there. Yeah. Anyway.
We had some quality time at Rivet
together.
I know. And now
did.
He's here, which is amazing.
Which is lovely.
Doing the 5 a.m. thing.
I'm surprised that anyone's out right now because everything is so slushy outside on the sidewalk.
Yesterday, leaving here, first of all, I was wearing what I thought were sensible flats. They were not appropriate shoes for walking.
Unless you were wearing like hip waders, nobody was dressed appropriately yesterday.
Oh my God, I left here yesterday. At every intersection downtown was just covered in water.
It was bad.
And slush. There was no dry land to be found. I walked from here to the West Loop over by Ogilvy, and I got to the point. I was taking Wacker Drive, and I cut left on State Street, and I was walking right on the east side of the Renaissance Hotel building. And I thought, oh, this is really slippery. I need to be aware of my footing here. And just as I was thinking that, I was airborne, completely slipped, landed on my hip.
In the slush?
In the slush,
yeah.
Covered from neck to foot in sopping, disgusting slush.
Freezing.
Gross. It was just, I felt so disgusting. Mm-hmm. And then I had another 10 or 15 minutes worth of walking after that, freezing.
So
miserable.
Those wet clothes had a chance to freeze to you.
Oh, gosh.
That's good.
It was awful. I took the most satisfying shower in the world when I got home last night. But then I had to shovel after that. And
aww.
Shoveling was the worst because it's like shoveling dense. It's just shoveling water, really.
It's slushy.
Yeah. So I was sore. I was achy. Mm. It was just weather was miserable yesterday. But you knew that.
I did know that. I tried to make it across the street from Tribune Tower to the Walgreens across the street, and I about wiped out twice, and I just kind of gave up and went to Lower Michigan. I was like, I'm just going to stand here for a minute because I can't deal with it. All I need is toothpaste. All I got to do is go to Walgreens and buy toothpaste. I finally made it, but it took quite a while to get over there.
When I was airborne, I thought, oh, I hope no one's watching this. I hope I'm not going to end
up on
Twitter.
You know, somebody tweeted that, like, look at this guy. This dude wiped out.
Look at James Van Ostel.
Yeah.
Should have worn some boots today, bruh?
Well, that's the good news about winter is that no one can recognize anybody because we've got hats and hoods and things like that on. So, you know what? I did not grow up in Chicago. I grew up much south of here, and so I'm not necessarily wired for cold weather, but I have determined that this year I'm going to embrace it.
What does that mean?
Well, it's difficult to stay happy and cheerful all winter long because it's, you know, we've got long stretches of gloomy gray days, mm-hmm. and it's not, you know, it's kind of uphill by February. We're all like, all right, I'm ready for the springtime. And indeed, one of my favorite things about Chicago is that as soon as it's warm, we'll go outside in parkas and sit on outdoor furniture. We don't care because we know there's a small window for sunshine. So we want to live like there's no tomorrow.
Exactly.
Right? Because the season is so short of sunshine, which I love about Chicago. But I'm like, you know what? This year it's going to be different. I am determined to embrace winter this year. And I'm trying very hard. One thing I've noticed is that social media is not helpful for that at all. The minute it started to snow, even like seconds, everybody started complaining on social media.
Yeah, it's in the moment, and it's a shared experience. I mean, that's the beauty of social media, is we're all sharing this moment together. Hey, this
Yes, but do you think there's a possibility that maybe we say things because it's what's out there to say, because everyone else is saying that?
In the case of yesterday, I think everyone was equally miserable.
I was totally miserable yesterday because those were little ice daggers hitting me in the face, and I was really angry about it.
Yeah, it was like getting face acupuncture walking across the bridge over the Chicago River.
And I did not have on appropriate footwear, so I also was getting ankle acupuncture with the little pieces of ice. But I was like, I made myself stop and go, you know what? Pick something okay right now. Like, don't focus on the ice daggers. Don't focus on the fact that you cannot get across Michigan Avenue, which is silly, but I just feel like it's worth trying to pick out the good moments of like, you know what? Okay, I have really good gloves. My hands are warm. I'm good. My coat is great. I have a good hood on. Like things like that. I'm going to focus on the good.
You are so glass half full.
I'm trying to be because I am, but not about winter. And I just feel like it's so useless to complain all season about something we know is coming. We choose to live here. Like we know what's going to happen.
I will say though, leading up to this, the weather's been pretty spectacular for December.
Yeah.
So when someone would complain on social media about the cold, the response would be, but yeah, it could be much worse. And people have been kind of glass half full up until this point. Well, usually it's X degrees and it's the wind chills this time of year. You should be grateful.
Yeah. Another thing I think that happens a lot is in the wintertime, if we see somebody we're connected to on social media going to a warm place and enjoying it, we're very mean to them.
Oh, no, I block them.
I don't. And somebody ridiculed me last winter for this because somebody I knew went to Florida in like January or February, and she posted these beautiful Instagram pictures of palm trees and, you know, lush greenery and an iguana or some craziness and the beach and all this. And people were commenting on her and they were kidding and they were doing it out of love, but it was still like, I hate you. You suck. No fair. And I know what they were doing, but I thought it's on some level, she's reading all like 20, 30 comments of just hatred. So I said, hey, good for you. I hope you're having a great time. I appreciate you letting us live vicariously through you.
I was kidding about blocking people.
I know you were, but still, people were making fun of me. They're like, God, Pollyanna, why are you such a dork about it? I was like, I think it matters. I think little comments matter.
Fair enough.
Totally not buying that.
No, I'm humbled by what a positive presence you are. And I'm aware of my own negativity.
Well, less than that. I'm not necessarily a positive presence, but I'm trying to find the good in winter because I choose to live here. I know the roads are going to get bad. I know everyone's going to freak out and forget how to drive. I know everyone's going to complain. Why waste energy on being negative? I'm going to be positive about it.
You're an inspiration.
Oh, boy. Now we're going to play some cheesy, light listening, adult contemporary music.
So do you go out on New Year's Eve?
You know, I like New Year's Eve because I think it's like a clean slate kind of holiday.
You're into the like pushing the reset button.
Yeah. Yeah. I like resolutions. I usually do a little bit of, I'll take a minute. I like, you know, to kind of go, okay, what happened this year? What can I do better next year? That's always my resolution. Just be better than I was last year. What about you?
Yeah, I don't really do resolutions.
Do you like New Year's Eve?
No. See, I don't drink. New Year's Eve is just another night for me.
Well, it's amateur night. I mean, that's where a lot of people are out doing very stupid stuff.
Without a doubt.
Who normally don't drink. So I don't like that. I don't like being around like sloppy, drunk people. I don't like big crowds. I like, you know, marking the day with something special and nice, but not necessarily like a
wrong.
Big crazy thing.
I do like having the opportunity to slide into a cute little black cocktail dress.
I've heard that.
I appreciate that aspect of New Year's, but it's fine. It's just...
You know, I feel like there's a lot of pressure on the day, though. I think people kind of feel like they have to go buy the bar package, and that's expensive.
Well, here's the thing. I was looking in New York City. It will cost, if you want, it'll cost you $400 for access to the Olive Garden, to get a seat at the Olive Garden in Times Square. Think about that.
I have no words for that.
No.
So if you'd like to ring in your new year with fettuccine Alfredo from Olive Garden and unlimited breadsticks.
But not unlimited breadsticks.
You get so $400 just gets you in the door.
$400 gets you in the door. It gives you an Olive Garden buffet, open bars, and a DJ. The open bars, lovely. But I don't believe the unlimited breadsticks are part of the buffet.
I don't think I can eat $400 worth of breadsticks. Yeah. that's the thing. People know that people feel like they have to do something really, really epic. And so they, you know, that's why like the dive bar on the corner will charge you, you know, $100 just to get in the door that night for the privilege of going in there and drinking.
Right.
You know.
$400 for Olive Garden.
No, not a thing I'm going to do.
That screams tourist. I can't imagine anyone living.
I can't imagine anyone being like, you know what? Let's leave Brooklyn tonight. Go to Olive Garden.
This is it. This is our night. Happy New Year.
Let's do this.
Let's do this right.
Yeah, no. That's not going to be a thing people do. But what would be the most, you know, if you had an unlimited budget, what would be the most epic thing you could think of to do for New Year's Eve?
An unlimited budget?
You do anything you want. Like, what is the perfect, epic
maybe,
New Year's Eve?
Maybe going out for an awesome dinner and being home
yeah.
early.
Yeah, see? See, right?
Home by 10.
Not fighting the crowds.
Door locked. Keyhole pulled in. I'm good for
chair
the
chair under the door to keep uh-huh. the hooligans out.
That's it. Maybe a nice fire.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, chill.
Nice roaring fire.
See, that's the way to do it. Well, it's going to be very different down here downtown this New Year's Eve because of the Chi-Town Rising thing that's
right.
happening.
Mm-hmm.
As we've been seeing it assembled behind us right here outside of the Allstate Showcase studio all week, this big star that's going to float up a building. But I imagine it's going to be so packed.
Oh, I can't imagine. Yeah, they've got Wacker Drive already closed off over there.
Right.
As they're getting everything set up, which was lovely as I was walking over. Just crossed against the red light.
Yeah, because you can walk anywhere. I mean, I think it's going to be like the way Times Square is, you know, just mm-hmm. shoulder to shoulder, packed people, all that.
See, going back to the idea of spending $400 for New Year's Eve, even if people don't have a good time, and this is my theory about concerts, too. If you spend a certain amount of money, an obnoxious amount of money, you are going to convince yourself you're having fun, even if you're not.
Even if you're not. You can't think critically.
No one can talk you out of it.
That's a good point.
If you spend $400, yeah, I went to Olive Garden, bro, on New Year's Eve. It was amazing.
Well, you won't want to admit. Well, that's a perfect example with concert tickets. Like if you see one of those once in a lifetime bands at, say, Wrigley Field, and you pay $1,000 to see them, you're not going to be inclined to say, yeah, that was not a good show.
Yeah, you can't be critical because, well, $125 to see the same U2 show everyone else across the country saw.
Right. That's a very good point. Very deep topics here for New Year's Eve that we have uncovered.
But it's true. I mean, you convince yourself that you're having a great time. And if you spend, let's say, $18 to see Star Wars in IMAX, perhaps you think the same.
Or perhaps not.
Perhaps not.
Good times. Amy Guth, James and Azul, we are in for Bill and Wendy. We're talking about all the things. When we come back, all the things. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Rex Hupke of the Chicago Tribune about politics and a very interesting political technology tool that is kind of silly and kind of useful. We're going to be talking about that in just a bit on 720 WGN. Ow. 720 WGN, Amy Guth and James and Osdall in for Bill and Wendy today, hanging with you till 3 o'clock. We're rocking out to that song.
We are.
It's a fine choice that esteemed producer Kevin Richter has made for music. So, my friends, we are days away from heading into an election year. It is so on.
Here it is.
Here it is.
Feels like the election year started a year ago. And
I know. I'm already sick of it, and uh-huh. we're just getting started.
Oh, wait until the ads just light up television. Just wait until they really go full force.
I know. Joining us right now is a good friend of the station and certainly a good friend of ours, Rex Hupke. He is a columnist at Chicago Tribune. You can read all about him and all the stuff that he does and writes and shares with the world at chicagotribune.com. Hi, Rex. How are you?
I'm great. How are you guys doing?
Good. Thanks for joining us today. So much to discuss. But, you know, I would like to talk about first maybe some local politics, because we're in that story about police officer Jason Van Dyke, who has just said he is pleading not guilty. And that, you know, we've seen a lot of that's a very polarizing topic in Chicago right now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Obviously, and it's not, I mean, we've also just had over the past few days here the shooting of two more people by police, one innocent bystander, basically, and that is, I think, really going to heat things up a lot more, and maybe rightfully so. I mean, you know, you hear people getting frustrated when they talk about protesters protesting Laquan McDonald, and then you see something like what happened, given all the scrutiny that the CPD is under right now with Officer Van Dyke and the Laquan McDonald situation, and then how does another incident like this that obviously we don't know all the facts on yet, but certainly raises some eyebrows and some serious concerns.
Yeah.
Where you have another kid who had a baseball bat, apparently, and then a woman in the building who was shot as well. I mean, you know, there's a lot of trouble going on right here. And I think the mayor is really a bad situation has gotten considerably worse and obviously more tragic. And now Van Dyke just keeps kind of compiling it and keeping it obviously in the news, which, again, I think it should be.
Yeah. You know, I was talking on this station just a couple of days ago about this topic with Max Grinnell, who writes as the urbanologist. We were talking about how, you know, we were kind of looking at the historical perspective, really, of protest in Chicago and the, you know, the attitudes around civic engagement and civil disobedience and change that has occurred and what's effective and what isn't. And, you know, it really struck me how much, you know, some of the same themes that we're looking at in our city right now were very much themes during Haymarket in, you know, 1886, right? I mean, it was still some of the very themes of excessive police force against unarmed civilian or relatively unarmed, not armed in the same way anyway. I mean, there were some rocks thrown, but certainly not shots fired. And, you know, and to me, that really speaks of a systemic issue. If over 100 years, you know, can't solve something, can't straighten something out, can't. And I know that Chicago is not unique in that. I know that this is, you know, communities are having trouble dealing, you know, relating to police, and police are having trouble relating to communities around the country. But that really struck me as, you know, here it was so many years later, and it's still some of the exact same conversations that we had around Haymarket.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that really struck me with the most recent fatality police shooting was if the Laquan McDonald case situation, if that had never happened and didn't already have, you know, sort of the red hot topic going on here in Chicago and across the country for that matter, if that had happened, if a kid with a baseball bat was shot and killed by the cops and this innocent woman was also killed, I don't know, it would have been news. I don't know how big of the news would have been, though. I think perhaps there was a time where we took some of this a little bit more for granted and people didn't really look that closely at some of the police shootings.
Yeah.
I think they're being looked at very closely now because of a combination of situations that have been captured on video, you know, things that really brought it to the front. But I think it raises a really strong question sort of historically about, you know, how much is this going on and how much has it just not really been picked up on? Because you can, I mean, a lot of shootings they don't get a lot of attention, you know, and they're the horrible situations that have largely, you know, been sort of inside the newspaper stories. I'm not saying that this would have absolutely been that if none of these other things had happened and if the Black Lives Matter movement hadn't risen up like it has, but it makes you wonder a little bit. I mean,
I was just saying, I think since Ferguson, we've seen a very different role of witness and bystander. You know, at a time, you know, when Ferguson essentially was on a media blackout, we were able to see what was going on because people whipped out their smartphones and started streaming video, and we were able to see it for ourselves.
Yeah, right. And I find it a little hard to believe that there has simply been a sudden spike in these things happening.
Right.
I think it's more that there's been a sudden awareness of things happening. And that isn't meant as a, you know, any kind of condemnation of police or anything like that. I think this is something that's probably been going on,
yeah,
and it's just not being noticed. And now it's being noticed, and people are being rightfully outraged about it.
Yeah, and I think, too, I mean, I kind of bristle a little when people say, well, the media isn't reporting, you know, the media is choosing to ignore. You know, that's such a troubling and fraught thing to say. I think it really... there was a New York Times story that I think of that in fact showed they released their own page view data saying, in fact, we did report this story, but 17 people clicked on it as opposed to the 2,000 people that clicked on this other story. So, you know, step off a little bit. So, I mean, I think it's an easy accusation to fling. But here, as you know, a member of the media who really I try to very carefully examine this topic because I think it's an important one. And I think it'll be very interesting to see how history treats it, and part of how history treats it will be how we unpack it in the public dialogue. You know, I'm really conscious of that. And so as I think of that, I tend to bristle when people kind of oversimplify, the media is ignoring it. No, it's complicated. There's a lot to it that we have to, you know, deal with and unpack with every step.
Well, and the other problem, I think the flip side of that argument that is also problematic is that if the media was trying to go hard at a topic that did not have the public's broader interest, you would have a lot of people saying, well, the media's got an agenda they're trying to, you know, right. The media, newspapers, TV, they do find things out and uncover important things that aren't on people's radar. That's part of the job.
Sure.
But the criticism can swing against you, too, when you're looking at something if it's not something that is, you know, that has become in the public consciousness. So, you know, people always want to blame the media. And I realize, as a part of it, I sound like I'm being defensive, but I really think that's always a relatively lame argument to just blame the media and say, well, why didn't you do something? You know, so.
Well, you know, I was in New York City when Pope Francis was in town a couple months ago, and I pretty much blamed him for everything. Everything. Like at one point I dropped my wallet. I was like, duh, thanks, Pope Francis. So, you know, people got to blame. You know, we got to blame somebody for everything, I think.
And the thing is, he's a nice enough guy that he's probably okay being a ball guy. He'll take blame.
Sure. Yeah, he's cool. The Pope's cool. He's fine. He seems nice. We're talking with Rex Hupke. He is a columnist at Chicago Tribune, and I call him the official unofficial political correspondent. So we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about what it means, what we can expect as we're stepping into 2016, this election year, and as the mudslinging begins, because that is what we do. So we'll be right back. We'll be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN.
Love this song. Comfort Eagle.
Yeah.
Cake.
I'm just saying, he's working off of my playlist for Showbump Music.
I love this song.
I'm just throwing it out there. Amy Guth, James Van Osdall in for Bill and Wendy, hanging out with you today, talking about all the things. And right now, we are talking with our good friend Rex Hupke. He is a columnist at Chicago Tribune. You can read all of the brilliance that falls forth from his brain at chicagotribune.com. Thanks again for being with us today, Rex.
Thank you. I don't know if everyone quite agree with that assessment. I appreciate it.
But nonetheless...
So, Rex, looking ahead to this new year, 2016, what's it going to be like for Rahm Emanuel? What's the prognosis for this guy?
Oh, yikes. Yeah, I mean, he's in deep trouble right now. I just don't – I mean, he's kind of lost, I think, so many people at this point. I don't think he's going to, you know, get booted or anything, but I don't see how he's effective in any way. I don't really see what, most importantly, I guess, is I don't see what kind of meaningful changes he can make here when he doesn't have the faith of really anybody, or at least a very small percentage of people in Chicago, and particularly people in the neighborhoods where you've had some of these horrible things happen with the police. I mean, it depends somewhat, obviously, on who comes in as, you know, the new police superintendent and you know, how things are handled there. You know, there's a possibility that he could come out winner if something significant happens. But, man, it's going to take a real sea change here to straighten this out. This is not just a local problem. This has, you know, put us in the national spotlight. And he does not look good in any way, shape, or form. And I think rightfully so.
It's not flattering lighting for him, that's for sure.
No. I mean, even CNN, I mean, you look at the crawler. Chicago's Mayor Emanuel cuts his Cuba trip short.
Yeah.
I mean, this is national.
Yeah. It ain't good.
Which I wondered as soon as, and I hate to sort of, I don't mean to take a tragedy like the shooting that happened and boil it down strictly to politics, but I did wonder that. I was like, I wonder if he doesn't get back here, that's just going to be preposterous. I mean, I was glad at least that he has responded that way to what's happened, because again, we don't know all the facts surrounding that shooting, of course, and so I don't want to speculate too far, but you know, an innocent woman shot and killed, you know, the whatever the facts are exactly, again, it's the young man didn't have a weapon, he had a bat, he didn't have a gun.
Yeah.
And so yeah, there's a lot of big questions there, and he's got to get on top of it. And sure, I think he could have probably maybe axed the Cuba trip completely.
Entirely, yeah, not gone.
A wise move politically, but at least he's coming back now and not just hiding there for a while.
Right, not hiding out for dear life, right.
So
as we step into 2016, as we look into the election year, obviously there's going to be lots of, I mean, there's already been lots of amazing, good and bad moments with the candidates. But, you know, there's usually the one or two big issues. And I've got to think certainly gun control is going to be a big, big issue in the election this year. But there seems to be so many. I mean, it just seems like such a crucial time with so many social justice movements happening with, you know, different, you know, so many different narratives kind of in a really huge crossroads right now. So it's, you know, what would your gut be right now if you had to kind of boil the election down to just those single issue voters? Who do you think they'll be, and what topic will they be working off of this election?
I think immigration is going to inevitably be, if not the primary issue, then one of the primary issues. And part of that is simply because of Donald Trump forcing that into the absolute forefront of things. So I don't think the GOP wanted that because that's a tough subject for them, obviously, in their base. So and I think Hillary Clinton will trip over herself to capitalize on that. I'm assuming, no disrespect to Bernie Sanders, but I'm assuming it's Hillary that moves forward as the nominee. I think she will go hard at, you know, her plans for immigration, which I would certainly guess will be more appealing to immigration activists and other people who care about that than what the GOP comes up with. So they've really backed themselves into a horrible, or rather they've been backed into a horrible corner there, courtesy of Trump. So I think that's going to be a large issue. And also that, I mean, economic issues always will bubble up to the forefront. I mean, now in the primaries, we have a lot of noise and a lot of sort of side issues that come up and stuff like that. So I think at the end of the day, economic plans and approaches play a large factor, and that for Clinton on the Democratic side, it's going to depend a lot on how the economy's doing. You know, it seems
Certainly.
To be making decent progress right now, which is favorable for her. If it starts to tank mid-year or early in the year or something like that, that could be a real problem, because people are going to sort of, whatever she says, they're going to kind of assume, I think, she'll keep moving in the same direction that Obama has moved, and so that might get people looking for a new approach. I think the economy comes back around to being a much bigger issue once we get into the general election. But also, I think gun control is a huge issue, and that's a tough one because there's a little bit more of a even split there in a lot of ways. You get that fires a lot of people up on both sides, and obviously, as we know, it's enormously divisive. So, I put those as three big things. I don't think you're going to see a lot of the social, same-sex marriage is not going to really be too much of an issue, except for maybe some evangelical voters. And so I think those are really the big ones.
So last night on Twitter, Trump versus Bush.
very low-energy competitor for Mr. Trump to take on.
So Trump retweeted a picture of Jeb Bush made to look like he was picking his nose, which he wasn't.
The fact that this guy is a legitimate, not legit, I mean, is a by far leading the field, and he's retweeting basically nose-picking. It's like a high school gag or something. It was absolutely, and that's like the least bad thing he's ever done. So,
well, I like the fact that Bush's spokeswoman, Christy Campbell, tweeted back, "Out on Twitter, there arose such a clatter. Late night Twitter drunk Donald is back at it."
But that's the problem. And the thing about this guy that is so, I think that people in the political realm are realizing what anybody who's had to deal with internet trolls realizes, which is it's borderline impossible to fight. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, no matter what you say, he's going to come back around and his supporters are going to rally behind him. And so he's kind of bulletproof on Twitter, at least, and he seems to be in a lot of other ways as well, but in terms of the poll numbers. So, yeah, he will, I mean, anything, you know, the stuff with Hillary Clinton now, he's going after Bill Clinton, saying, well, how can you call me a sexist when your husband did this, that, and the other thing? And it just, again, you know, it's a fact. The facts don't matter. Nothing really matters. He just says what he wants. It sounds tough. And all the people that like him say, yeah. And then they start tweeting the same stuff. And, you know, I'm sure the Bush nose pick thing won him, you know, another 20,000
sure.
devotees.
Sure. You know, we're about out of time, but, you know, I wonder, have you seen, there's an app, it's called Voter, V-O-T-R, and it's kind of like the Tinder for making political decisions. And, you know, you and I have talked many times about media literacy, particularly around election time, where people are getting email forwards, spreading misinformation, where social media can spread misinformation or obscure some information. And I wonder, have you seen this app and have you had a chance to play with it?
I haven't actually used it, but I read about it, and I think it's a really good idea and an interesting idea, because the people that would tend to use this, it may sound, you know, the path that you take to find sort of your matches politically may sound a little frivolous. I mean, you know, you like certain things, you don't like other things, and it's getting, well, similar to like a Tinder app or something like that. But what it does do, though, is it actually is a way of getting people to get informed and sort of quickly, too. I mean, people are not as inclined, I think, to dig up casual voters and stuff aren't as inclined to dig up all the information that they need to on their candidates to make, you know, more informed decisions sometimes. This allows them to kind of filter stuff down quite a bit. It's almost like a candidate aggregator in a way that, mm-hmm. that'll help you get at least some information. And then hopefully, you know, once you get that, you look a little more closely. So I think it's a really good idea. And I certainly don't see anything wrong with it. I could see people being quick to say, oh, no, you're, you know, making light of the political. But I don't think so. I think the people that use it would generally be savvy enough that they take it for what it is. And then, you know, if they want further information beyond that, they would go and find it.
Yeah, and I think, too, it's going to help. I think it kind of forces you to pick issue by issue. Okay, well, what do I think about guns? What do I think about immigration? What do I think about X, Y, and Z? And it kind of makes you take things issue by issue rather than just, I like this persona and campaign versus this other one, you know, which, you know, that works. I think, too, for, you know, there's always the concern for young voter apathy. I don't know that that will be the case this particular election. I think there's so many young people that are engaged right now politically, but I think it will help negate some of that young voter apathy a bit.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think anything like that that can get people talking about this, thinking about it, you know, kind of probing the issues a little bit more is a really great thing for everyone, truthfully.
Indeed. All right. Rex Hupke, thanks so much for being with us today.
Yeah, always great to. Thanks for having me on.
Always a pleasure. All right. That's Rex Hupke from the Chicago Tribune. Go to chicagotribune.com. You can read all of his stuff. He's got a column every week. Sometimes he writes two or three just because he's a funny guy. He's got a lot of things to say. So we're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back in just a bit and get you to news on 720 WGN. WGN. Amy Guth, James Anazzo in for Bill and Wendy today. Hanging with you till 3 o'clock.
It's true. And it's New Year's Eve week, New Year's Day week. It's New Year's week. And to celebrate and kind of talk about some strategies, we brought in Jesse Valenciana. Jesse is the founder of ManBQ, which is a social club that originated right here in Chicago. You are a meat enthusiast. You are a beer enthusiast. You are a rock and roll enthusiast. An all-around good guy.
Oh, thank you.
So New Year's Eve. Wait, for those of us who don't want to go out, for those of us who want to have maybe some friends or family, small gathering at home, we wanted to bring you in and talk about maybe some libations that would be appropriate.
Oh, man. So you guys know that I love beer, but this past year I really dove into like mezcal, just dove in there. I'm in there now. I love it. And I've been doing a lot of different cocktails with mezcal and learning a lot about it. So,
see, my limited knowledge says that's trouble. You don't want to mess with mezcal on New Year's Eve.
Well, that's the thing. It's like if you're going to go like white girl wasted, then yeah, don't touch mezcal. But if you want to have, you know, if we're adults now, we're all in our late 20s here.
Yeah.
So, I think we can agree we're all 29 forever.
I'm 27. So, you know, if you want to do like a cool cocktail, they're all over the internet. So mine's not the best one, but I do a mezcal mule. It's like a take on the Moscow mule. So it's a little bit of lime, pineapple juice, and ginger beer. So it's like a really tasty cocktail. And again, it's it's different than just having a cocktail to knock you off your butt. So
sure.
Yeah.
And then what about food pairing with that?
For that, so I was telling you guys before that I just put up a recipe on mabbq.com. It's a Red Bull barbecue slider recipe.
Oh, I'm so in. I am so in for that.
It's you know, I started cooking with Red Bull a few years ago. I did these Red Bull wings, and I'm sick of them now because everybody started asking for them, and we were doing these catering gigs, and people were like, can you make the Red Bull wings? And it's like Red Bull and soy, and now that smell together, it makes me bonkers.
So what is that? I can't even imagine what that tastes like. Is it kind of like a fruity, or how does that land once you cook it?
You know, like barbecue sauce tends to be, you can do like a sweet barbecue sauce. Mm-hmm. So this kind of takes the place of just putting sugar in there. So some people use like a, you know, ketchup base. This mm-hmm. adds just sugar to what already is going to be sweet. So Red Bull, like they put out a line of different flavors. And this, I use the yellow one. It's like a tropical fruit. And it really doesn't taste like you're on vacation. It just tastes like sweet. But it's good. And it's, you can make these sliders. And I kind of joked on the website about, you know, when you go to a New Year's Eve party, you want to bring good beer, not just beer, and like bring a really nice dish that'll just wow everyone. So when you're peeing in the, you know, laundry closet, nobody can blame you because you made such good food. They'll forget about that.
Well, you know, we were talking about this yesterday on the show. We were talking about how much craft beer is, I mean, it's just this, it's beyond exploded. It's obviously such a big thing that we're trying to speculate about what the next frontier of craft beer is. And we were kind of joking that it was the hyper local, like neighborhood beer or apartment 74, you know,
apartment 409 beer is the best in the entire building.
Right, because it's getting so local. And so, but I also think it's kind of overwhelming right now. If you're trying to buy a good craft beer, it's hard to know what's what. And, you know, what are some of your recommendations right now?
Locally, there's a bunch of really good stuff happening. You know, obviously you've got the Goose Islands of the world, the Revolutions. They've been doing it for a long time and they make really solid beers, but you know, I'm really excited about, there's a new brewery opening up on the south side in this place called The Plant. I think you guys have heard of it. It's like a big space, and mm-hmm. They're kind of doing like this whole you know, sustainability project, and Weiner Beer is opening up in that space. Their brewer, Brian Taylor, he used to brew for Goose Island, and the guy is a madman. I mean, he's like a master when it comes to making beer in wine barrels. So what he's doing that's completely different, that not a lot of people are doing, is putting these barrel-aged beers in cans. So, you know, for the longest time, there was a stigma, if a beer is in a can, it's not good, but that's not what the case is anymore. So this guy's putting this beer that normally comes in these really nice 20-ounce bottles, these, not just bombers, but like these, they look like champagne bottles, and he's putting them in cans. So Weiner Beer, They're coming around, and they're going to be really awesome.
So it's like back of the yards ish uh-huh. area, right, where the plant is. Yeah. So what does that do to the flavor of a barrel aged beer to put it into a can?
Well, the can, you know, you're always worried about kind of light pollution when you're putting beers in bottles. So with a can, it eliminates that. There's also, you're not really getting like a flavor off of the can as well. Plus, like, I mean, as far as storage, too, you can store more cans than you can the big bottles, you know?
Sure.
And I think also, like, from a psychological standpoint, if you see, like, a really nice big bottle, you're kind of like, eh, maybe I don't want that. I think I just want this beer in a can. So
makes sense?
Yeah.
Well, it seems like by volume, too. If you see, like, some of the craft beers are in such big bottles, you kind of have to commit to, if I open this, it's, I got to drink it.
Yeah.
Right? But sometimes you just kind of want to, like, a taste. And it seems like a can's more, I think, to your point, psychologically more like a serving.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, I'll go through a six-pack and be like, I don't want that big bottle. I'll just have one or two of these beers, and then six-pack is gone. So, yeah.
I think part of the appeal of craft beer is the labels. It reminds me when I used to go record shopping, and I'd buy records just based on how they looked. I mean, I don't need to know what the flavor is, or whether it's a lager or an ale or a pilsner or whatever. They're cool labels.
Yeah, you know, there was a while where it happened in wine, too. Like, there was always wines out there that had these crazy labels, and people were buying them based on the labels, and you ended up with this junk wine, but it had a really cool label. So for a bit, some breweries were, like, really cool and hip, and they're like, you know, let's put all this time into art, and then the beer was just flat and mediocre. Mm-hmm. But now it's all starting to catch up a little bit. You know, like, all the craft breweries that started off a couple years ago are getting better and better. And same thing with the artwork. You know, not like now these breweries are finding artists that they're really comfortable with, that really feel and fit their style. So, yeah, I mean, I go on I go to different liquor stores across the country, and that's the first thing I look at. You know, it's like, oh, that's a really cool art.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool artwork. I wonder what the beer tastes like.
Well, you know what really strikes me about the craft beer world is that it certainly seems, at least from the outside looking in, it does seem very collaborative, and not. I don't get the sense of a lot of competition. I'm sure it's there, but it certainly feels a lot more collaborative, and the labels only seem like yet another place to extend that collaboration with artists, with, you know, different people outside of beer.
For sure. You know, you look locally, Half Acre, the artist is Phineas. He does this amazing work for them. I mean, their labels are just outstanding. Then they do, you know, aside from the labels, now these guys are creating posters based on these labels. So for breweries, it doesn't end with that can or that bottle of beer. Now you can make money. The revenue stream kind of expands because now you're selling T-shirts, you're selling posters with that artwork from those beers. So
Jesse Valenciana is here. He is the founder of ManBQ. It is a Chicago-based social club. He's a beer guy. He's a meat guy. And we're talking New Year's Eve, ways to prepare, things to buy, things to load up your New Year's Eve party and make it awesome. So we'll come back with more from Jesse, James Van Oslin, and Amy Guth on WGN.
WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth and James Van Oslin. We're in for Bill and Wendy today with you till 3 o'clock.
It's all true. And Jesse Valenciana is in the studio. Jesse is the founder of ManBQ, which is?
A cult based around meat, beer, and rock and roll.
It's a cult. Y'all wear the same shoes. You have the same beards.
We do.
The same lumberjack-like flannel. That's standard issue.
So you don't know if we...
They're like Dickies for meat enthusiasts.
Pretty much.
So Jesse's here. The reason you're here, well, besides the fact you're a delight, you're here because New Year's Eve is this week. And for those of us who don't want to drop a couple hundo to wait in the line outside in uncomfortable clothes, you just want to entertain at home, you're the guy to talk to. We want to know what we should be drinking, what we should be eating. And you're a cookbook author, and the new cookbook's on the way in 2016
yep.
about street food. But the current ManBQ cookbook is available on Amazon, and it's a bargain at any price. What would you recommend from that cookbook for New Year's Eve?
You know, I love making for New Year's Eve, you don't want a big commitment. You know, there's a lot of really good slider recipes in the book. Sliders are always nice and easy. Wings. John Scholl, one of the authors on the new book, lifelong member of ManBQ, he's like the wing king. That guy comes up with like wing recipes like it's nothing. So he's got some really good wing recipes in that book. And actually, if you go to manbq.com, we've got a bunch of recipes on there that would work well for New Year's Eve. There's a lot of finger food kind of quick, easy recipes that, again, for New Year's Eve, you don't want to spend all day cooking.
No, and you want to create something finger food, something people can just kind of grab and go and walk around and talk. And
yeah, don't make a meatloaf. Don't make a
not
turkey
the day for a bowl of soup. No, not that.
What's wrong with soup, Amy? I made lentil soup yesterday. It was amazing, but it took so long. It's a labor of love.
Was there bacon involved anywhere?
I made it vegan.
So what's the point of that? Explain this.
Them's fighting words to JBO.
Yeah. It was cold outside.
He's the meat guy. He's meat, beer, rock and roll. He's ManBQ. He's making vegan stuff.
It was cold outside.
I don't understand anything anymore. Night is day.
Cats and dogs.
Dog is cat. Day is night.
I'm sorry to let you down. It was just too cold yesterday to do anything. Again, John Scholl, he posted a picture on Instagram that he was grilling outside. I'm like, oh, you're so cool. I'm staying in and I'm making soup.
What can I do with quinoa for... I'm just kidding.
I was going to say, are you talking about kale next? What's happening right now?
What's wrong with kale? What's going on, guys?
Oh, boy. It got weird. I think, okay, for New Year's Eve, though, I think there's kind of two camps, though, right? There's if you are hosting the party, you want to make it easy on yourself and you want to make it easy for your guests because you don't want them to have to schlep around a plate of something. You want them to be able to kind of talk and walk and all that. But then I think a lot of people make food that they can take somewhere. And usually that ends up being like, I'll just get chips and salsa or something. Or, you know, they kind of like wimp out and don't get something cool. But there's lots of stuff. So I think there's the portability that you have to think of, too, when you're thinking of New Year's Eve food.
For sure. And you also have to keep in mind what food will fit in your pocket. So at 2 a.m. when you're hungry and all the dishes are empty, you want a snack on something like some pocket wings, some pocket meatballs. You guys don't do that? Is that just me?
I should.
You should.
You're a visionary. teach me, Jesse Valenciana. Teach me.
The secret is this, James. But yeah, of course. Like you said, Amy, it's portability. You want food that, if you're bringing stuff to a party, you don't want to again bring like all these dishes and have to account for the people that are hosting the party because then you have to get plates and No, just like something easy. I don't ever recommend crock pot recipes, but.
Oh my God. Thank you for saying that. I tried to do crock pot cooking over the past month. Everything came out bland and like soggy and just not good. It's a very efficient way to cook, but it's not a very tasty way to cook.
It's kind of gross. Do you ever see like if you look down at a crock pot and there's food sitting there, it all ends up looking like brown.
And no matter what I do, everything I make in the crock pot has a similar taste to it. It's not like when you cook in a cast iron skillet and you know, all that different cooking kind of collaborates in the iron. There's a weird consistency to everything I make in the crock pot, that just this weird taste.
Well, it's all just sitting there cooking. So like if yesterday when I was making that lentil soup, you throw onions and garlic in there and then spices, and then you kind of sit on that and then you start adding other ingredients. So everything's kind of given its time to shine and cook. And then it's like a collaborative effort where a crock pot's like, bleh.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, like if you've got a pot out, you know, you're going to like, you know, braise or like sear your meat, take it out and then do your vegetables and deglaze and all that. And you're kind of building all these flavors as opposed to just like dumping a bunch of stuff in a little tin pot. I'm very anti-crock pot myself.
Yeah.
It makes me sad.
So, all right. So New Year's Eve, you are a beer enthusiast. You know more about beer than most. But if you are trying to please the greatest number of people, what's a cool beer that people may not have had that would be, you know, pretty crowd, like nothing too heavy? Like what would be a good crowd pleasing beer?
Well, that's the thing. I think if you're the host, let's say, have a variety of beers, right? There's such a range of beers. So have something this sounds like a marketing term, but a drinkable beer, you know, like a lager or a pilsner, something that's not going to assault the palate. And then have something maybe a little bit more malty, like a nice porter. You know, Goose Island has Four Star Pilsner. It's kind of a lightly hopped Pilsner. Revolution has the Eugene Porter, which is a fantastic porter, nice and malty, comes in cans. And then, you know, sneak in a couple of big beers, almost like these harder to get beers, or do something funky, like get some Belgian ales in there. You know, stuff that people really aren't really used to maybe or aren't familiar with. So if you know a little bit about beer, you should kind of show off that you do and try to get people into beer more. So yeah, I mean, there's, again, always have a variety of beer. I feel that's the best.
So if you are into beer and can show off that knowledge, super. But say you maybe can't, maybe you're kind of newer to the, or maybe you would like to know more about beer, right? Where would you start with that? And how many varieties would you get?
Ooh,
you want to make yourself look like you're in the know with craft beer.
Again, start with, go through the spectrum of beer, you know, German, nice traditional German beers, Kolsch's, lagers, pilsners, and then again, go with like, get some stouts, you know, some big stouts. A lot of craft breweries put out really nice stouts around this time, like milk stouts. I know there's a brewery out in St. Louis, Four Hands Brewing. They do this peanut butter stout, milk stout, and it's amazing. I just had some last night.
Does the flavor come through? Does it taste like peanut butter?
It really does. It's really balanced. You would think that it's like gimmicky, but it's so tasty. And the peanut comes through. So, and then there's Spiteful Brewing they're up north. They do this raspberry milk stout. So again, they make you seem like a little bit more of a craft beer person, I guess, because they're not around all year and not everybody knows about those. So
like a seasonal only would be a good jumping off point.
There you go, seasonal. There's the word I was looking for.
Peanut butter beer. I bet that'd be awesome with a jelly donut.
Oh.
Now that is some,
I thought I was a food
that
guy.
Is some food pairing right there. I'm on board with that.
Yeah.
Done. Hitting up glazed and infused before your New Year's Eve.
Like a Nutella donut with bananas and a peanut butter stout.
Done.
I got to go.
Sign me up.
All right. So Jesse Valenciana of ManBQ, the new cookbook is called what?
Eat Street. It's all about street food.
And that comes out when?
April 26, 2016.
And you're taking pre-orders?
We are. Online right now.
Like how I'm guiding him through this?
Right.
Yeah. I can't sell myself very well.
And it's awesome?
It's the best book ever.
All right.
And how many recipes are included in that?
200.
That's a lot.
It's 80 more than the first book. I blame you, John Carruthers.
Putting together a cookbook sounds like a huge task. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Cookbook number two. ManBQ.com is where we can get more recipes, more wisdom, more insight.
Yes.
Real quick for your New Year's Eve, what are you listening to, rock and roll enthusiast? What's on your New Year's Eve playlist?
Honestly, since they went live on Spotify, the Beatles. I almost started crying when I heard them on Spotify. I love the Beatles. So It's been like Beatles every day. It's gross. But it's good.
Favorite Beatles album?
Maybe, I don't know, Abbey Road, it's a good one. The White Album, obviously, I think. Let's go with the White Album.
See, I didn't think that was obvious.
Really?
Yeah.
I like it. I think it's it goes through their ups and downs.
Well, that's
on
just
the
it.
One album. Yeah.
To me, it's inconsistent.
I like it.
I'm a Revolver or a Rubber Soul guy.
Rubber Soul is good.
Amy Guth?
I'm going to go Revolver, probably.
Yeah.
She said. Come on.
I'm telling you, I'm going through everything.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. It's awesome.
Yeah.
All right, Jesse Valenciana of Man BQ, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
For bringing New Year's beer and food wisdom.
Beer and cheer.
All the good stuff.
That's it.
Amy Guth and James Van Osdell in for Bill and Wendy. We'll be right back in just a bit, and we'll get you to news here in a sec on 720 WGN. Amy Guth and James Van Osdell in for Bill and Wendy. We're chilling.
We are. You know, I love these end of the year things that happen annually, one of which being the people at the American Dialect Society are trying to figure out which word to make the word of the year. And they've narrowed down this list of words from a bunch of different categories. They're going to meet about this in early January, but they want to figure out what their word is. Now, dictionary.com already picked identity. Oxford Dictionaries picked the emoji, the face with tears of joy, which is a favorite. It's a crowd pleaser. But the people at the American Dialect Society are narrowing them down. Some of these words, I don't think need to graduate to word of the year. For instance, deflategate. It's really a one-time use.
It's a one-off
yeah.
thing. It doesn't need to be more than one.
The scandal was also known as Balghazi.
No.
No. Nope. Dad bod is in contention, which we know and appreciate that it refers to the pleasing, flabby physique of an adult male. The aesthetically attractive, arousing dad bod.
Is it?
Oh, it sure is, Amy.
You know, I'm glad to see something like that, though, because I think before then, the only kind of parental, you know, body thing we talked about was like mom jeans. So I'm, you know, dad bod is,
dad bod.
You know, let's keep the playing field level.
It's harder to take the calories and weight off as you get older. Just saying. Netflix and chill. This needs to die with fire. This is terrible. And it's a euphemistic thing for hooking up.
Yeah.
Because let's face it, there's never anything on Netflix. I could sit in front of, I pull it up on my Roku and I'll just keep scrolling up and down and across and I can never land on anything I want to watch.
Yeah. And like once in a while, the recommendation tools will kind of serve up a gem.
No, no matter how much they insist, I will never watch Snowpiercer with Chris Evans. It's not going to happen.
Don't do that.
No. But I never see anything. I think the reason why they're getting so aggressive and really good with original programming is because they just don't have the streaming catalog.
Yeah.
The archival stuff, the movies that would be attractive. I think that's why they're investing so heavily in original content, like all the Marvel Comics stuff, like Jessica Jones and Daredevil.
Sure. That could be. But nonetheless, it has become an unfortunate euphemism.
Yes. Netflix
and chill.
Yeah. There's your New Year's Eve right there. Netflix and chill. With some craft beer, as recommended by Jesse Valenciana of Man BQ.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Also on the list of candidates, deconfliction, the military term for avoiding airspace conflicts. That came up when the U.S. and Russia held talks about the Syrian conflict. That's on the...
That's one of those words like strategery or strategery where we were joking about the Bush administration. It's like one of those kind of not real, real
bit.
Words, you know. Yeah, I could pass on that one.
How about opt-outer? This is for parents who want their kids to opt out of the Common Core.
Right. And it sort of reminds me of the misuse of the word onboard, which is already a buzzword, so it already hurts my ears.
How are we going to onboard these clients, Amy?
Yeah. Not everything is a verb.
You know, we got to onboard these listeners on WGN. We got to onboard them to what we're doing. What's the best?
And I've heard people refer to new hires as onboarders. And we're in the onboarding process. No.
Dark web is on the list. The shady regions of the World Wide Web.
Well,
much of the dark web confuses me. I don't know or understand it.
Well, I got a crash course in the last year, and it's there's some unfortunate reaches to the internet, as we have the right to say what we want on the interwebs. But there's some unfortunate things happening on there, as well as some really fantastic things, right? I mean, I've long said the best part of social media is that it lets us connect with people on the other side of the world that we otherwise wouldn't be able to connect with over common passions and joys and things like that. And that's super good. There's also a more destructive element and a not so wholesome element, and it's there. It's going to be there. I've gotten a crash course in that.
I was watching Inside Man, the Morgan Spurlock. Speaking of Netflix, I was binge watching that because I couldn't find anything. So I watched the Morgan Spurlock CNN documentary, Inside Man, which I think is really good. He does a nice job of treating each topic even-handedly. But as he went into Bitcoin, he addressed some of the dark web, and he went on Silk Road, and it's crazy. I mean, I forgot what the exact statistic was, but what we do on the internet is we Google and Facebook and tweet and go on Wikipedia. That is just a fraction of the actual traffic between dark web, military, et cetera, of what actually happens on the internet.
Absolutely. And so much of it is not for, wholesome means. I mean, when we think about it, like the doxing and things like that, that's just kind of the tip of the iceberg going into.
I had never heard that term before. You introduced me to that term. You should explain.
Really?
Yes.
So doxing is the practice of putting someone's personal information out on the internet, usually in a not very obvious place, for the purpose of doing them ill will.
Which is horrifying,
but a very, very common practice.
And it's a way to decentralize an attack on someone.
Right. It's very hard to prosecute it because you're already masking your IP address. So it's hard to tell exactly who is involved in this. But it's often a situation where one person will post someone's personal information, and then a group of other people on that forum, they may not even necessarily know each other. They will kind of come together to attack that person through cybersecurity violation, things like that. Some of that has, escalates to real life. Some of that, I mean, it's very scary, but that's why I'm making a documentary to help people out with that.
Also on the list, wexting. I'd never heard this. This is a portmanteau.
I love the portmanteau.
Walking while texting.
So, okay,
wexting.
There is a pedestrian lane in, I don't remember where, in China. I don't remember the town, though, they have painted their sidewalks to identify there's a specific lane for walking and texting.
I see that, walking just to WGN the past couple of days from the West Loop, there's so much of that. Heads down, kind of weaving like they're drunk as they're walking up and down Wacker Drive or Michigan Avenue. It's a thing.
It's kind of a game to me. If I see somebody texting and walking and they're going to walk into me, I will get as close as I can to them just to see what they do. And they'll get right up on you before they look up and go, oh, sorry. Got it. And they kind of panic, and it's like they think you're attacking them or that you are in the wrong.
Yeah, how'd you get here?
Yeah.
Unicorn. This is a startup term, which I had never heard in relation to startups. Startups valued at $1 billion or more first earned the title of unicorn in 2013. But there's a new explosion of members of the Unicorn Club.
Yeah, it's particularly popular in the venture capital area where you're investing in something that you know is just going to be a slam dunk. You're going to make a ton of money, and that valuation is going to turn around really high when you go public or when you first kind of open the doors. It's a unicorn. It's this mythical thing that probably doesn't come along very often. But the thing is, there's been so many of them, and it's become a buzzword, and people kind of talk about, I'm going to go find my next unicorn startup. And that's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime thing. We're talking about Facebook. We're talking about Twitter. We're talking about big things that have gone really well and made a lot of money in a relatively short period of time. So there's not very many of them. I mean, there's the tech giants for a reason. It's not the tech village. It's the tech giants, right? So there's not many of them. They became so popular that there's the other side of that, and that's the unicorps, is when you kind of overinflate something thinking it's going to do really well, and in fact it's kind of a dud, and you have this kind of dead company with a lot of money you put into it.
Do you think there are a lot of people at 1871 sitting in front of whiteboard saying, bro, we are totally a unicorn? Fist bump me. We are so unicorning this.
Unicorn's not a verb. Unicorn can't be a verb.
We are totes unicorning our venture here.
No.
One more for this list that is being considered by the American Dialect Society. Actually, I can't read that one. But squad goals. I haven't heard anyone use this. Squad goals.
Are you on Instagram?
I am.
It's a lot on Instagram. a lot.
So explain what that means. What's a squad goal?
Well, I'm not saying it's a good thing. It's just that's where I see it all
well,
the time.
I know, but I don't, out of context, it's just something you and your friends want to do.
Want to achieve. Yeah. So if like you see a picture of a group of people doing something and you like, those are 10 people on the moon and there's 10 of us, squad goal.
Okay.
Right.
It's kind of cute.
It's, I suppose, interesting shorthand for saying, I would like to do that as well.
Yeah, that's kind of cute. There's another side to this, words that we just want to have go away entirely.
Here's where I'm a Viking. I have a long list of these.
A Viking?
Yeah, that's from The Simpsons. Sleep, that's where I'm a Viking.
The Simpsons?
Come on.
This has been on for like 40 seasons. I don't know all the quotes.
I do.
Okay.
But we got to take a break before we get into all those, because there are many words that need to go away.
From just period.
And if you have one of those words in your mind, on your heart, thinking, weighing heavily upon you, give us a call, 312-981-7200, and we will talk all about it. And we will unburden our souls of the words that need to just go away.
James Van Ostel, Amy Guth, WGN.
WGN. Amy Guth and James Van Ostel in for Bill and Wendy.
So looking at USA Today, a headline made me cough blood.
Terrible.
Young and shirtless Harrison Ford is so, five O's, bae. Young and shirtless Harrison Ford is so bae. This is in USA Today, which, as I understand it, is a news organization. And, well, he, you know, if you look at the picture, holy God, he is so bae. But the
wait,
point is,
you just, I saw, that was not
him. He's the dude with the peace sign.
Oh, that, I was looking at the other guy. Yeah. I was like, wait, what?
No, he's got the dad bod.
Yeah,
the aforementioned dad bod. But that got me thinking, wow, the word bae is awful and obnoxious. And I was trolling around the World Wide Web, and I found a list of medias that need to be banned from our collective vocabulary. And sure enough, bae is on it. Now, if you don't know what bae is, which, you know, that is totally fair if you don't know what bae is, it's a term of endearment often referring to your boyfriend or girlfriend or a prospect who might one day hold such a lofty position. Like Amy Guth, you're totes bae.
Thanks.
Yeah.
But I think but it's used outside of it's in other contexts too.
Like?
Well, people just say that as like someone I admire or want to be like or something like that too.
If I'm not mistaken, it means before anyone else.
Yes, it does. I was hoping he was getting.
Oh, so it's an acronym.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Oh, all right. So it's like NASA. Bay is like NASA.
Bay is like NASA. I think we just titled the podcast, Kevin. I think we know what the pullout quote on this bad boy.
Bay is like NASA. And Harrison Ford is so bay. Our number here is 312-981-7200. If there's a word you think should just be jettisoned into oblivion.
Yeah, there's a lot of those words. My big thing is making things into verbs that are not verbs.
Right, like
onboarding. Things like that. That's not a verb. Not everything has to be a verb.
True.
I think language has gotten very extreme, and it's, I mean, this is kind of like a nerdy, longer conversation for another day, really, but I feel like language has gotten so extreme that it's exaggerative, constantly exaggerative. Everything is epic and amazing. Not everything is amazing. Sometimes people just go, my neighbor is literally amazing. Well, no, your neighbor's a nice person, and it's okay to just say that. It's okay to say my neighbor's nice. Or
Amy, you and your word discussions, I can't even.
Me and my accuracy. Ridiculous.
But that's another one. I can't even.
I can't even. Yeah.
That's, it amused me for a little bit, but I think we're done with that.
Shall we take a call?
I can't even.
Let's do this. Hi, Julie. You're on WGN.
Hi. I am really tired of hearing the term reach out.
Oh, reach out.
I'm going to reach out. Yeah, I'm really sick of it. Everybody's going to reach out to everybody else, and it's, I can't bear it any longer.
Yeah, that's a good one, right? Because it applies to so many things, and people just say, I'm going to reach out to you, or I'm going to circle back with you later. Yeah, those are
not the circle back.
Circle back and reach, especially in customer service. Let me reach out to you and see what we can do, and you never hear from them again.
Right. Because it means nothing, right? It's this nebulous other that actually, in fact, means nothing. But if you were to say, I'll call you, I'll email you, then it actually means something. That's a great one.
Exactly.
Thanks for the call, exactly. Julie. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
And ping would be a synonym for that. That's another
what?
One that bugs me. Ping.
I thought you said something else.
Come on now. I'll ping you later, Amy.
Yeah. Cool. Ping me with that. What?
Nope.
I don't know you like that. What?
You know, it's funny. I downloaded the extension to my Chrome browser that turns the word millennial into snake person. So every time the word millennial shows up in an internet article, it automatically becomes snake person. So I'm looking at my list. Millennial is one of those words, but it's actually snake person.
That's outstanding. There's another Chrome plugin that will change. Gosh, what is it? I think it changes Trump to Voldemort.
That's fantastic.
I think that's the other one. And then there's one that will change. Gosh, I can't think. There's another Trump one, and I think it changes it to like Barney the dinosaur, something like that. That's fun.
How about Fleek?
You know, I always hear people say things are on fleek when they're referring to eyebrows the most. That's where I see it. People take a selfie of their makeup or something and say, my eye makeup is on fleek.
I've never said that.
I can't see you saying
intentionally.
That.
Intentionally, no.
Well, let me say it for you. Your makeup is on fleek.
Thank you. Thank you. It's because I don't overdo it. I do enough to accentuate my eyes, but I don't push the eyes on you. It's all about subtlety, Kevin.
It's about bringing out your natural beauty.
Yeah, and I have nice tone.
Bringing out your inner fleek, I think.
I don't even know what these words are. Lit and turnt. T-U-R-N-T.
It's like hyped up, and sometimes it could mean like drunk or a really epic and rough night, but...
So like on New Year's Eve, Amy Guth, I'm going to be so turnt. I'm going to be so turnt, I can't even...
Killing me was saying this with such a straight face.
Oh, I'll tell you what. I know for a fact my outfit's going to be on fleek. I'm going to be turnt.
Okay, let's
be
go
hanging
to
with
some
my bae.
So some kind of web-based ones that are less hashtag and more, you know, things people aspire to do, or like the business buzzwords that really drive me crazy.
We could go on for days there.
Synergy. Sometimes you just mean stuff works. That's really all synergy means. It works. Hey, we collaborated on that. JVO and I did radio. There was synergy.
Nice,
no, yeah. It was fun. We had a fun time.
We have a synergistic radio show. Uh-huh.
Especially when you add in like you're going to strategically leverage the synergy of the
leverage.
Partnership. Nope. I'm out. I'm done with that one. And then viral. I mean, viral is one I've thought of a lot about because people will say, I'm going to make a viral video. No, viral is an outcome.
Right. You can't plan for that. You can hope for that.
You can put the elements there and make a very funny video, make it highly shareable, optimize it for search. You can do all those things and put it in a good place to win. But you can't say, you can't walk out the door with the outcome in front of you.
And I'm sorry. I hear the word viral. I think Ebola. I think gonorrhea.
You think of something you can't put down.
Right.
Yeah, I know. Absolutely.
Not thinking about YouTube. Just doesn't. But yeah, optimize is another one. We need to really optimize that.
I would like to ban the guru, rock star, that whole grouping of language, like ninja, like all of those. Sometimes people can just be good at something.
Yeah, I see a lot of that on LinkedIn.
Like, yeah, people list that as their job title.
I'm a social media ninja.
No.
Nope, you're just someone who had an entry-level job that was kind of cool.
You had the keys to the Twitter account. That's really kind of it. Yeah, but I see a lot of that. Like, I'm a radio guru. No.
No, and that's something you don't want to be. I got to be honest. that's not an aspiration.
Dubious honor, my friend. Yeah. Dubious honor. But I think it implies a certain level of, I think it's important to be a student, a perpetual student, and always be learning. And particularly in the areas of technology, it's important to stay open and be mindful of that because it's always constantly evolving. The minute you call yourself a guru, you're saying, I've learned it all.
Yes.
I overthink things, and you know this about me. And that's what I do. But
you know why? Because you're a thought leader.
Oh, God. Yes.
And
that's another. People say thought leader. People say I've even heard people like identify themselves, and that usually goes hand in hand with the misuse of the word keynote. They'll say, I went to this conference. My conference had 11 keynotes. So, like, by definition, the keynote is the one that sets the tone for the event. There should just be one of them.
Yeah. Unless there are a bunch, in which case they'll be benchmarking the event.
Oh.
There's another one. Don't like that at all.
No. God, the buzzwords kill me. Because I think it's like designed to exclude people. It makes it hard to get into a club, you know?
And culture is another word. That's a word that meant something at one point, but when you hear a company talk about its culture,
it's usually saying this is a terrible place to work.
It is.
That's usually what that means.
To me, the surest sign that a company is not a good place to work is if it has a description of what its culture is and it has core values. If it tells you,
oh, everybody's at core values now.
It's brutal.
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying it's not.
I mean, really, our core value should be being good to ourselves, our partners, and our customers, and not sucking. That's it.
Don't
That's
be
it.
A,
Done.
Just don't be a jerk.
Uh-huh. That's it. That's all you need for your core values. Your business will succeed. Done.
Done.
Mm-hmm.
You are the best motivational speaker I have ever heard on this station.
You know why? Because I have a game plan. I'm goal-oriented. I don't look at things from a half-pregnant position.
What does that even mean?
I'm you know, I look at things from a high level. Like
half
a 30,000...
pregnant?
Yeah, you don't...
I've never heard that before.
Really?
You're either... You're,
I had a boss
you're
who used that
or
word
not.
All the time.
You're not like half-pregnant or half-gay or half... Like there's some things you can't do by half. I'm just saying.
I started using that after a huge paradigm shift over the past year, Amy.
You're killing me with the buzzwords. All right, my friends.
We should regroup.
We should regroup and take a break.
I don't think this conversation is scalable.
Oh, my God. You. I'm turning your mic off. No more buzzwords.
Wait, I'm a stakeholder in this show. How dare you?
Oh, God. Producer Kevin, help. All right. Amy Guth and James Van Asdal. We'll be right back.
Wait. I want some transparency.
Oh, my God. We'll be back in just a bit on 720 WGN.